The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily radio show. Yesterday, President Obama gave a 43-minute speech to the Islamic Society of Baltimore. It was his first visit to a mosque during his presidency. And he quoted from the Quran and praised Muslims for being such a crucial part of America's history. It was very similar, some of the content very similar to the New Beginning speech that he gave in Cairo back in 2009. And I'll comment more on that speech. We've talked about that so often over the years and just how that really was a significant moment with respect to Bible prophecy. What he said there in Cairo, June 2009. I'll start today with a few clips from what he said yesterday. This is in the Baltimore mosque.
Now, this mosque, like so many in our country, is an all-American story. And by the way, the notion that America's at war with Islam ignores the fact that the world's religions are a part of who we are. We can't be at war with any other religion because the world's religions are a part of the very fabric of the United States, our national character. So the best way for us to fight terrorism is to deny these organizations legitimacy and to show that here in the United States of America, we do not suppress Islam. We celebrate and lift up the success of Muslim Americans. That's how we show the lie that they're trying to propagate. We shouldn't play into terrorist propaganda. And we can't suggest that Islam itself is at the root of the problem. That betrays our values. It alienates Muslim Americans. It's hurtful to those kids who are trying to go to school and are members of the Boy Scouts and are thinking about joining our military. That kind of mindset helps our enemies. It helps our enemies recruit. It makes us all less safe. So let's be clear about that.
Those two statements, we put two together there. The first one, though, I'll draw your attention to, where he said at the start that this mosque, like so many in our country, is an all-American story. And yet, if you saw some of the reports, even about this specific mosque, the one in Baltimore, this from Fox News a few days ago, it talked about one of the former imams at this particular mosque who had ties to the Muslim Brotherhood and also to another mosque in Northern Virginia where the radical Anwar al-Awlaki used to preach. This from Fox News. It says, as a Muslim American, well, it quotes from this Muslim American who works at the American Islamic Forum for Democracy, that he was just insulted by the fact that of all the mosques that he could choose to speak at, the president chose this one. Fox News says the former imam in question is Muhammad Adam al-Sheikh, who served at the Baltimore Mosque in 1983 to 89 and then 94 to 2003, a member of the Muslim Brotherhood in Sudan. He had moved to the U.S. in 1978 and went on to receive several advanced law degrees as he became involved in the religious community. During his time in Baltimore, it says, al-Sheikh was a regional director for the Islamic American Relief Agency, the international parent organization of which has been cited by the U.S. Treasury Department for connections to al-Qaeda and the Taliban. After 2003, he was the imam for the Islamic Center in Virginia the one near Washington, D.C. It was there, this article says, that Al-Awlaki, just months earlier, gave his fiery sermons before going on to be a top Al-Qaeda affiliate operative in Yemen. Al-Awlaki, a U.S. citizen, was killed in a U.S. drone strike in 2011. So here you have these two mosques with ties to this radical imam that went off to fight against U.S. soldiers, U.S. policy, this administration in Yemen, and was finally taken out by a drone strike in 2011. Surely, of all the mosques in the United States, there would have been one better, perhaps, for the president to speak at. But in the rest of that clip that we played for you, I think what else we can draw attention to here, because it is so revealing, is where it said, the president said, this is the best way for us to fight terrorism, the best way to fight terrorism, to deny that these organizations are legitimate, or that they're Islam, or that their roots are in Islam. He said that kind of mindset helps our enemies. It helps our enemies recruit. So if we just keep ignoring the fact that there's a religious component to this at all, then this is our best way to fight against terrorism. This is our best way to win this war against terror. And so, as you know, we've covered this before, this administration has really bent over backwards to avoid, in the case of that Cairo speech, to avoid even saying terrorism. But when it's had to say terrorism, it certainly doesn't say radical Islam along with it. They're just generic terrorists who aren't religious at all, who aren't connected to Islam at all. I want to take you back to 2015. This is a year ago now. This is right after the Charlie Hebdo attack, and you see this almost ridiculous exchange between a reporter and the White House spokesman, Josh Earnest, as he's trying to explain here why they don't use the term radical Islam.
Right, but the leader of France, your ally in this effort, has put a name on this ideology, which he calls radical Islam. You have bent over backwards, you know, to not ever say that. There must be a reason.
I think the reason is twofold. One is, I certainly wouldn't want to be in a position where I'm repeating the justification that they have cited that I think is completely illegitimate, right? That they have invoked Islam to try to justify their attacks.
To call it radical Islam, you feel would be playing into their hands.
Well, I think what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to describe to you what happened and what they did. These are individuals who are terrorists.
Right.
And what they did was they tried to invoke their own distorted, deviant view of Islam to try to justify them. And I think that is completely illegitimate. And what we should do is we should call it what it is. And it's an act of terror. And it's one that we roundly condemn. It's an act of terror that was roundly condemned by Muslim leaders across the globe. There are reports that at least one of the victims of the attack in Paris was actually a Muslim. We know that at least one of the hostages in the kosher grocery store was a Muslim. And one of the things I think that has been particularly inspiring about the march that we spent a lot of time talking about yesterday is the kind of solidarity that we saw among the French population. This is a diverse country, but we saw French Jews marching with French Christians and French Muslims in a sign of solidarity to condemn these terror acts and to demonstrate that country will not retreat in the face of that kind of violence.
Have described the ideology that you call a warped view of Islam by calling it radical Islam. They're not saying we're at war with Islam. They agree with you totally in every word you just said. But they are calling the ideology, the warped view that these people adhere to, by a name. And it seems that the White House has gone to great lengths to avoid ever calling it anything other than, you know, warped view. And I'm wondering, is there a reason for that?
Yeah, and I guess I'm doing my best to try to explain to you what that is. The first is accuracy. We want to describe exactly what happened. These are individuals who carried out an act of terrorism, and they later tried to justify that act of terrorism by invoking the religion of Islam and their own deviant view of it.
So they're just, it's a kind of a long clip I played there, but you see the back and forth. You see, as the reporter even pointed out, you see the great lengths that the administration has gone to just say they're terrorists, they've committed acts of terror, and we're not going to connect them or satisfy them by connecting it in any way to radical Islam. And so from the beginning, now if you go back to the Cairo speech, there was the new beginning, reaching out to the world of Islam. That was in 2009. And look at where we are in the world today. Just look at the world, even the world of Islam. Look at it as it is today. After that Cairo speech, you might remember my father, you know, when the president came out basically defending Iran's nuclear pursuits and ambitions, my father came out and predicted the end result of this pacifist approach, this appeasement of America's enemies. He said the president thinks that through his words he will have peace with Iran. But after the terrorists heard that speech, they had to be rejoicing. When America's president gives a speech like that, the terrorists have contempt for such weakness and are stirred to fight even harder. They can smell the victory. So we can expect violent terrorism to intensify and shake the nations. My father said we won't have to wait. We won't have long to wait to see who's right. It's a pretty bold prediction. If you just leave aside for a moment that not every Muslim in the world is a jihadist, but has the world faced more serious and violent and bloody acts of terrorism since the Cairo speech? This was the new beginning, remember. This was America reaching out to the world of Islam. And 7 years, at least almost 7 years on from the Cairo speech, the Muslim world is vastly more radicalized than it was before that speech, that first speech. That's just the reality of the world we live in today. And you can try to explain it in soft terms or act like it's not really increasing in intensity, but it is. And it all gets back to Daniel 11 and verse 40. Even the New York Times today, in talking about the speech yesterday in Baltimore, it said for Mr. Obama, the remarks were also an admission of how little progress has been made since the speech in Cairo, where he called for a sustained effort to listen to each other, to learn from each other, to respect one another, and to seek common ground. In his speech on Wednesday, the New York Times says, he suggested that his hopes for a reconciliation had been dashed. But he called on all Americans to stick by the country's founding ideals. His hopes had been dashed. Why is it? Why is it that in coming in, whether it's to fix the problems with race right within America or to reach out to the world of Islam, all of these sincere efforts to make peace, to befriend enemies, why has it all gone so wrong? Why have the hopes been dashed? The hopes for reconciliation? Why is the United States more divided than ever? Why is the divide between Islam and the West more sharp than ever? I thought it was interesting, too, in that New York Times article this morning. It says Muslims in the audience hailed the address. This is the speech yesterday in Baltimore. I think it was one of the best speeches he's ever given, said Representative Andre Carson, an Indiana Democrat. Representative Keith Ellison, a Minnesota Democrat, said the speech hit me in the heart and was a vital antidote to growing intolerance. I mean, it all sounded so good yesterday. It was one of the best speeches he's ever given. And meanwhile, the hits just keep right on coming from radical Islam. The attacks just keep right on coming. Iran, by the way, kidnapped another reporter just yesterday. A BBC reporter detained, quote unquote. The AP says the detention took place as Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Zarif, that's the one that was in all the negotiations with Secretary Kerry. He's due to arrive in London today to participate in meetings. AP says the reporter's detention is part of an ongoing crackdown on journalists and activists in Iran. Western journalists, we might add. We told you about the kidnapping of those three in Baghdad. That happened on the same day, or at least the day before the deal was finalized, the nuke deal on January 16th. I mean, here they're just rounding up Western reporters from Britain, from the United States, contractors, you name it. And the world is supposed to be safer, we've been told. And the nuke deal benefits everyone, we've been told. Well, it all sounded so good back in 2009. It was a new beginning. A beginning of what, exactly? My father, again, you talk about some bold predictions. After that 2009 speech, he said we were witnessing a reenactment of the 1930s between Chamberlain and Hitler, where you have Western nations trying to negotiate their way to peace. Hasn't the lesson of history proven that attempting to appease an enemy that talks repeatedly about destroying you, it never works? Well, Daniel 11:40 reveals the nature of this radical Islamist agenda. Its nature is to push, to provoke, to antagonize. And by failing to confront it, of course, it just makes the problem worse. Now, Europe's going right along with this U.S. approach. But soon that will change. And Daniel 11:40 talks about the coming clash between Europe, between the King of the South. Just wait till the strong man shows up. We'll touch on that more in the second segment. But wait until the strong man shows up and he finally stands up to this king in the South. There's a coming clash. My father said at the end of his article, this is the 2009 article that he wrote in response to President Obama's Cairo speech. He said, President Obama's speech is a great turning point in this world. It's going to play a major role in terrifying prophecies of your Bible being fulfilled. It is beginning because of the broken will of America. God is going to shake this world and start by shaking America, Britain, and the Jewish nation for their sins. God is shaking the nations. He's shaking our nations. This was a great turning point, that Cairo speech. It certainly has played a major role in many terrifying prophecies of your Bible being fulfilled. We've seen it happen. We've seen it unfold. As my father said earlier in that piece, I read it a moment ago, we can expect violent terrorism to intensify. We don't have long. We won't have long to wait to see who's right. And so 7 years on from the Cairo speech, what do you see? Well, you see a United States of America that has empowered far more jihadists than it has neutralized. Who can deny that? Who can deny that? We've empowered more jihadists than ever before. Is there an Islamist government that was in power before the Cairo speech that's since been overthrown? Well, Iran could have been. Had the United States gotten behind the uprising in 2009? Or perhaps left the sanctions in place? That maybe could have been one, but can you think of an Islamist government that's been overthrown or that's lost power since 2009? And then at the same time, how many states in the Middle East, in North Africa, have come to be more dominated by Islamists or even ruled over by Islamists that weren't that way before 2009? These are the undeniable fruits that have come from this policy of appeasement, from this policy of reaching out. That one Democrat that was there at the speech yesterday talking about the problem, the growing problem of intolerance, I guess from those on the Republican side, Donald Trump or whoever, as if that's the big problem facing America and the West today, an intolerant attitude or view toward Muslims. As I recall, there were neighbors next door to those attackers in Southern California who knew something was wrong, but they didn't speak up because they didn't want to say anything that could sound like they were racially profiling Muslims. And so they kept quiet. To me, that doesn't make it seem like the biggest problem the U.S. has is an intolerant attitude toward Muslims. Step back and look at the world that you live in today. You see the King of the South in place, as powerful as ever, flush with cash, as we've covered in recent weeks. And now we just wait for that strong man to emerge out of Europe to stand against that King of the South. And meanwhile, the United States, weakness, problems that are not solvable, and it continues. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond. The live stream's available at kpcg.fm and also at thetrumpet.com, the newly designed website, thetrumpet.com. Send us those emails, td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
The prophet Daniel wrote about a future confrontation between a power in the north and the king of the south. We are now in the time when these two major powers are quickly rising. The King of the South is stirring up trouble even today. It is critical that you know the identity of this prophesied power. For more, request our booklet, King of the South. Visit thetrumpet.com and click the Literature tab to select your free booklet.
From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England. This is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
This week I've been going through He Was Right. I'm looking for some ways to try to advertise that a bit more on the TV program here in the UK. But what a wonderful booklet, if you haven't read that in a while. It's been, I know it's been updated a few times over the years, but the one I'm reading, I'm kind of amazed at just how right up to date it is with some of the latest from even a couple years ago. And there is, of course, with each passing year, there's always more that can be added to a booklet like this. But as you probably know, it's basically about the prophecies, the sure word of Bible prophecy that Mr. Armstrong had in all of his writings, in his broadcasts, his programs. And that signature prophecy, as we talked about several weeks ago, about the formation of the Ten Kings, that grouping, that union in Europe, led by a strong and resurgent Germany and a strong man, and the influences, or rather the influences of the Vatican upon that that united force. I want to take you back to a sermon that Herbert Armstrong gave back in 1982. It was just a few years before he died, but in this sermon, he's actually hearkening back to the very first issue of the Plain Truth. And I saw this, I read the quote anyway, and he was right. And I thought, well, this would be great to actually listen to see what he said. He's talking, as I say, about the first issue of The Plain Truth and just how accurate this was, this first issue from back in February of 1934. Take a listen.
Now, the very first issue of The Plain Truth was published in February 1934. It came out right on the 1st of February, 1934. That is practically 49 years ago, just almost 49 years ago. Well, the heading is a World Dictator About to Appear? Will it be Mussolini, Stalin, or Roosevelt? Now, Mussolini and FDR were both in office at that time. It continues. Everybody senses that something is wrong with the world, that some mighty event is about to happen. What is it? Bible prophecy tells. Here is a solemn warning, and it is the plain truth. We live today in the most momentous, anxious moments of Earth's history. Today, we stand on the very threshold of colossal events that will stagger the mind of mortal man. Just now, it is like the lull before a great and devastating storm. Everyone senses it. Then there was a subhead, the lust for world power. Ever since the pharaohs ruled in Egypt, down into ancient Assyria, Babylon, Persia, Greece, and Rome, on to Napoleon, and then to the Kaiser, and then to the time that I was writing, with Mussolini was in office, there has been a lust for power to rule the world. It is commonly known today that Mussolini's whole aim is to restore the ancient Roman Empire, that is, the resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. Now, this was nearly 49 years ago that I wrote this, in all of its former splendor, power, and glory, and Rome ruled the world. Now, as a matter of fact, it was about that time that Mussolini proclaimed he had done that very thing. Prime Minister MacDonald of Great Britain and President Roosevelt are striving frantically to avert or to postpone the impending next world war. World War II had not yet come. For the next world war, while the nations prepare even more feverishly for that war. Three or four short years ago, many laughed and scoffed when I said that there would be another world war in 5 to 7 years. They do not laugh and scoff now. Everyone knows that the world war is coming, and soon. And it did come in 1939, and this was written, this was written in 1934, and World War came in 1939, just 5 years after I wrote that. So once again, the plain truth, even in its first issue, was way ahead of its time, was predicting what was going to happen. People scoffed. They said, that's a crackpot. He doesn't know what he's talking about. But World War II did happen. It did come.
So much detail. I mean, this was in the first issue of the plain truth, and it was easy to dismiss it, as Mr. Armstrong said, and to call him a crackpot and to say that he didn't know what he was talking about. But I think it brought to mind what I talked about just the other day when we went through Daniel 2 and the 10 toes and so on, and about how much prophecy is there and how much detail God has given us. And the same can be said about another prophecy over in Revelation 17. We've gone through this a number of times before. Revelation 17 and verse 8. It says, "The beast that you saw was and is not, and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit, and go into perdition, and they that dwell on the earth shall wander, whose names were not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they behold the beast that was and is not and yet is." So this refers to the sixth head. There's to be seven resurrections of the Holy Roman Empire. You can read the verses preceding this about the woman straddling the beast, representing this great religious system, this universal Christian church. But where it says there in verse 8, "and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition," that's talking about the seventh and final resurrection. Now, as we've pointed out in our literature, Mr. Armstrong, of course, again, talk about detail. Mr. Armstrong was on the scene for the sixth head. He was talking about it there in that quote. The very first issue of The Plain Truth, written in 1934, and him talking about a world war coming, and the war did come in 1939. He was there. He was on the scene. But he wouldn't live long enough to see the seventh and final resurrection. Well, he did see it. If you understand prophecy, if you read what he wrote, so much of it, the highlights, it's right there, and he was right, the booklet. I mean, you could say he saw the early stages of it all, the European Economic Community and so on. But here, this is talking about one verse here in Revelation 17. It's basically about two eras of God's church. The era of Mr. Armstrong, and then, of course, the era that followed. And another man, another prophet who would come on the scene and be here for the seventh and final resurrection. It says there that this beast, well, where it went into the bottomless pit, how that it went underground. Mr. Armstrong made this point in his literature. After that sixth head, it didn't last very long. There in the World War II era. But if you look at your copy of He Was Right, this is on page 5. First, it talks about how that in August 1944, how the German industrialists got together, sensing that they were about to lose the war. And so they instructed their top officials to prepare themselves to finance the Nazi Party, which would be forced to go underground. It says here, by 1944, the Germans knew they would lose World War II and were already planning for the next round. Existing financial reserves in foreign countries, the document says, must be placed at the disposal of the party so that a strong German empire can be created after the defeat. That's according to a document from 1944. It wasn't revealed or made known to the public, declassified, until 1996. So many, many decades later. But when you think about that document from 1944 and then this statement from Herbert Armstrong in 1945, this is the next year. The war is just ended. He says, men here, Mr. Armstrong, says men here, talking about the UN, the first UN conference, men here to preserve the peace of the world, or they plan to preserve the peace of the world. What most do not know is that the Germans have their plans for winning the battle of the peace. We don't understand German thoroughness, Mr. Armstrong said. From the very start of World War II, they have considered the possibility of losing this second round, as they did the first. And they have carefully, methodically planned in such eventuality the third round, World War III. Hitler has lost. This round of war in Europe is over. And the Nazis have now gone underground. Now a Nazi underground is methodically planned. It says they plan to come back and win it on the third try. Again, you put that statement together with that document from 1944, a document that the world didn't even know about until 20 years ago. It's remarkable. Again, the detail, the understanding, the vision of a man of God who relies on the sure word of Bible prophecy. Verse 9 says, and here is a mind, the mind which has wisdom, the seven heads are seven mountains, this is Revelation 17 and verse 9, on which the woman sits. And there are seven kings, five are fallen, and one is, and the other is not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short space. Look at all the dramatic detail revealed in this passage. Here we are right now, in the midst of this prophecy being fulfilled. My father wrote in his booklet, Prophesy Again, Mr. Armstrong came at a time when the beast that was and is not and yet is, he was on the scene when the sixth head rose to power before World War II. He was also there after the beast lost World War II and is not, in other words. He was still there when the beast went underground and yet is. Again, my father just picking apart these verses and pointing out all the detail. He says, but also note that the other is not yet come. So Mr. Armstrong was prophesied not to be around when the seventh head appeared. He was taken out of the way so the rebellious Laodicean era could unfold. That's referring to a prophecy in 2 Thessalonians 2. And that's what happened. He was removed in 1986. The Laodicea era emerged, and an entire church fell away from the truth and now rejects this prophecy and so many others. It says, and the beast that was and is not, even he is the eighth and is of the seven and goes into perdition. It says in verse 12, and the 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings, which have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. This refers to the United States of Europe. Project Europe is not dead, as we discussed on Monday. It's not over. Europe's going through one crisis after another. That's for sure. But those 10 kings will come together. They will receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. I mean, it's going to be short-lived. We're not talking about a decades-long empire here. What we are talking about is 10 heads of state in Europe joining together and receiving power. It says in verse 13, these have one mind and shall give their power and strength unto the beast. They'll be united in this short stint that they have. Verse 14, these shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them, and the Lord of lords and King of kings, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and they that are with him are called and chosen and faithful. So that gives you the time frame here. It leads right up to the return of Jesus Christ. And right in the midst of this great prophetic vision, you see God's people right in the center of this prophecy, fighting alongside the Lamb, putting down this evil beast power once and for all, so the world can finally rest and have peace. This is the action that God must take. This is the action that Jesus Christ has to take to bring the world into submission. It's not just nice-sounding speeches that brings peace to this world. It's the government and the authority of God. It's the family of God finally putting down this rebellious spirit of man, where there's just so much hostility, so much antagonism, so much hatred for God's truth, for God's laws, for God's government. You can look more over in, well, Revelation 19 is just a few pages over, about this war. Verse 11, Revelation 19 says, "And I saw heaven opened, and behold, a white horse, and he that sat upon him was called Faithful and True, and in righteousness he does judge and make war." Christ makes war in righteousness. That's true. This is what it takes to finally get the world's attention, to finally help the people of this world see that man's ways haven't worked, that all these good intentions to reach out, to start anew, to have a new beginning, to finally bring peace, to finally make that peace deal, to negotiate our way to world peace, even as we continue on with our many, many sins, it doesn't work. It hasn't brought peace to this earth. Everything man attempts to do to make it better makes it worse. These are the facts. Verse 16, "And he has on his vesture and on his thigh a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords." And then down in verse 19 it says, "And I saw the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies gathered together to make war against him that sat on the horse and against his army." See, man has just never wanted to submit to the rule of God. But this is the point when finally God will impose his will on human civilization. And you can go on and read chapter 20 and see where the devil is going to be bound in chains, unable to continue, deceptively, powerfully deceiving the people of this world, as it says in Revelation 12 and verse 9. Back to verse 15 of chapter 17, Revelation 17 here. And verse 15 says, "And he said unto me, The waters which you saw, where the whore sits, are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. And the ten horns," verse 16, we didn't read the first part of this chapter. You'll just have to go back and read those first seven verses later on your own time. But it says here, "And the ten horns which you saw upon the beast, these shall hate the whore." Eventually, this church-state union is going to fall apart. Again, the union itself in Europe is short-lived. This is all brought out. And he was right, this wonderful booklet. It says in verse 16 again, "The ten horns which you saw upon the beast, these shall hate the whore and shall make her desolate and naked and shall eat her flesh and burn her with fire." Verse 17, "For God has put it in their hearts to fulfill his will and to agree and give their kingdom unto the beast, until the words of God shall be fulfilled." That's what it comes down to. These words of God, these prophecies, all these details, they shall be filled, as Mr. Armstrong, fulfilled rather. And as Mr. Armstrong said, there were those back in 1934 that would have scoffed at that first headline, that first issue of The Plain Truth: "Is a world dictator about to appear?" He wrote that in 1934. And look at what happened in the years that followed. Spot on. And then afterward, Germany crushed. Germany was just absolutely crushed. And what was Mr. Armstrong saying? What was he saying in the late 1940s? What was he saying in the 1950s? What was he writing in the 1960s? Well, let me take you through a few of the highlights from this first chapter, part one. And he was right. It quotes from The Plain Truth, November-December 1954. Germany inevitably will emerge as the leader of a united Europe. You see it today, but he wrote it in 1954. He wrote it 60 years ago. More than 60. I mean, it was written just 10 years, 9 years after World War II. Germany at that time was divided and still crushed from the defeat. Disunited and in rubble. Well, they made some pretty rapid progress in rebuilding, particularly West Germany, thanks to the Marshall Plan, primarily. In any event, no one would have said this at the time. He was right, says, that excerpt contains the essence of one of the most powerful prophecies in the Bible. Mr. Armstrong repeatedly stressed that the prophecy revolves around three key points. Germany, as leader of a united Europe, a spiritual binding force, that would be the Vatican, straddling this union. And then three, a confidence-inspiring leader. That's the strong man. That's the strong man. So again, you can look at these prophecies and see, I mean, some of it's already been fulfilled, and a lot more detail is about to be fulfilled. But you can look at this and see where it's all leading. Notice this next bit. It says, and he was right, page 3, in World Wars I and II, Germany and its allies had attempted to achieve global domination by first conquering their European neighbors. In 1956, shortly after both of those German-led efforts had failed, Mr. Armstrong made a stunning prediction about a vital change Berlin would make in its next and final attempt. Now, this is a quote from 1956. This time, Mr. Armstrong said, this time the Germans plan to sidestep the causes of past defeats. Instead of exhausting their own strength by holding European nations as captives, at the expense of vital Gestapo manpower, they plan to head and dominate a United States of Europe and add the manpower of those nations to their own military divisions. There's a different strategy this time around. This time, Germany would become the dominant power without having to conquer those neighboring states in Europe. Without having to hold those European nations captive. That new plan would be to head up and to dominate a United States of Europe. So you see Europe today. Again, there's crises to be sorted out. There's some downsizing that's coming up. But who can deny? Who can deny just how spot on, how accurate that forecast was and is? You've got Frankfurt, home of the world's most powerful bank. Germany, unquestionably, the economic powerhouse, and now becoming so much more assertive militarily. Wait until the strongman shows up. And he finally seals the borders. And Germany then joins forces with a fewer number of nations. And that union coalesces together, that mixture of iron and clay, for a short time, all having one mind. Well, there's a lot more that I could cover, as I said. There's the section in part one about that signature prophecy, and then the second part about the Holy Roman Empire, about that additional power besides the strong man that serves as the glue that brings all those fractious nations together. This brittle mix of iron and clay. But to sum up, let me just read to you what it says on page 6 of He Was Right. Page 8. It says, but the prophecies Mr. Armstrong published and broadcast to multiple millions over his 57-year ministry are smacking the gainsayers square in the face. Just as he prophesied World War II ahead of its time, so he prophesied World War III way ahead of its time, giving cogent detail of the conditions that would prevail in Europe just before the war explodes on the world scene. Cogent detail. So much detail. He prophesied that Europe would unite under a resurgent German nation. That's happened. That's happened. He prophesied that a confidence-inspiring leader would arise to lead the seventh resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire on its final crusade. Europe is crying out for such a leader. Germany's crying out for that leader right now because of the refugee crisis. They're crying out for Merkel to step down. And they're in search of a strong man. And then back to He Was Right, this last one, the last point it makes, summarizing this first chapter. Mr. Armstrong prophesied that a spiritual binding force would draw Eastern Europe out of Soviet communism, back into its spiritual fold, and weld a united European economic, monetary, political, and military force together as the final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. Well, much of that's happened. Those Eastern European states have come out of Soviet communism. They're back into the spiritual fold. And now we just wait for it to be downsized to the 10. And now we just wait for that confidence-inspiring leader, that strong man, to emerge right out of the heart of Europe. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond. The live stream, as you know, can be listened to at thetrumpet.com and also at kpcg.fm. Keep sending in those emails. Hopefully we can read a few more tomorrow or perhaps at the start of next week. Thank you for joining us today. Let's continue this conversation tomorrow.